James, as a leader of the Jerusalem church, had a special respect for influence near and far. So, as others have said, this letter is an epistle to any and all Christians who might read it. The letter was copied by hand and shared between one congregation and another. Today, such a letter might be made with a shared email to be made accessible to all. It might be posted on an internet website for generations afterward. In one sense, this letter has now been preserved in the cloud nearly 2,000 years later. As noted, his message was intensely personal and practical. His message was how we should live our lives of consecration. In this way, the message gives us an insight into those matters that touch the everyday lives of those brethren in the first century. Furthermore, we find the same matters as still necessary today. So our assignment is to review the third chapter, or the third page of this letter, in a way. Brother Russell says on reprint 4380, his third chapter is generally acknowledged to be one of the most profound dissertations known in the world on the power of speech. This is crucial, as the words of our mouth are regarded as an index of the heart. Our words may not always indicate the deep-seated intents of the heart, yet those words, when unrestrained, may either reflect some deficiency or that the heart is not properly monitoring the impulses of the flesh. The first 12 verses addresses the subject of the tongue. In verse 1, his notable caution opens that masters or teachers are especially on trial and judgment in this matter. Teachers use the power of the tongue to sow elevating seeds or devious seeds in the ears of others. He's now saying that there should be only few rather than many instructors. Or he's not saying that, there should be only a few instructors. His caution concerns, let not everyone dare to be a teacher, because it bears great responsibility and consequences for dogmatic contention. There are many who undertake to show that the way of salvation, who know nothing of that way. In other words, there are self-appointed leaders who are blind leaders of the blind. That thought leads on to, in verse 2, to a series of considerations as to the government of the tongue. He who can completely keep it under command is a perfect man, because the difficulty of doing so is great, that the attainment of it is a test of perfection. He will not give others a warning without at the same time applying it to himself. As the tongue is an index of the heart, hard words indicate either that the heart is not mature or else it is not on guard against the weakness of the flesh. In verse 3, James introduces the figures of horses, where a bit is literally placed in the mouth to control the movement of the horse. It is a powerful idiom, as our obedience begins with our mouths also. In verse 4, the lesson continues that the helm or rudder of a ship that is able to give direction to the whole ship, the words are small, they are capable of ruling the whole man, or irritating and offending others. He says in verse 5, the tongue is a little member, like the little rudder of a ship. Yet it can do great things, whether of a good or evil kind. A voice above a mob can move them to protest, revolution, and violence, as the voice of Lenin and Trotsky. Otherwise, the compassionate voice of a wise orator can calm them to do good and be merciful, as a Vasily Ințea from the roof of a Romanian police station. A few words can change the course of history. Verse 6 can have various meanings. The tongue can defile the whole body and set on fire the course of nature and set on fire a sense of destruction. So it is with passionate, vehement, compulsive words. The course of nature is literally the wheel of life. This metaphor is used in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 6, for the heart and pulmonary system. Under passion, the heart raises the blood pressure. The very face is reddened, and perhaps the whole being is threatened. Another application of the wheel of life is that of successive generations of men. The tongue has been the instrument of confusion and misery through all ages of the world. The tongue of orators, of philosophers, of religious rhetoric, of fear and idolatry have marked the course of culture and nations for generations after generation. Coming to the 7th and 8th verse tell us that man has tamed or domesticated nearly every kind of creature. However, his own tongue remains unruly. The deadly poison of the tongue is compared to the tongue of serpents as the means of injecting poison into the wounds made by the needles of their teeth. The wound is first made with fear, sorrow, pain, or guilt. This is followed by the poison of deceit, vengeance, hatred, or lies. We should not be surprised that this marks our own days and times as we look out across the world. Verses 9 through 11. But how strange it is that the same tongue can become blessings or a curse. A well-trained dog may lick your hand. An ill-trained dog may be expected to bite your hand. But either one will not both lick and then also bite you at the same time. James reminds us that pure fountains don't also pour out bitter and salt water. This contradiction seems peculiar to the fallen human nature and ought not to be for the consecrated. Slander, blasphemy, and reproach are marks of the old creature. In verse 12, his example of figs, olive, and grapevines may carry a special symbolism. But the general lesson is that even nature teaches us that one species does not produce another fruit. If we are of a new nature, then we will be known by its fruit. Here is some direct evidence in verse 13. A wise man can neither bridle nor tame another man's tongue. Yet he can restrain and manage his own tongue. In this verse, he shows that conversation must be with knowledge. So much conversation is with thin impressions, opinions, observation, and popular appeal, but with very little information, very little truth. That is why it is so volatile and fluctuates with the wind. But then James says that this must be accompanied with wisdom. Wisdom that is born of experience. Those proud and overbearing with contempt pass for great scholars and critics, may have some learning, but they have not wisdom. Their learning implies their correct knowledge of the structure of language or nature, but not wisdom, nor any self-government. But James adds another word for wisdom. His expression is, let him show out of a good conversation, behavior, his works, his labor, with meekness and wisdom. There's so much that James has to say about behavior as reflecting a character. This is not just a matter of words, but of conduct. Now notice his expression. It is not with meekness and wisdom. It is meekness of wisdom. Meekness is an expression of wisdom, not just an accommodation. Wisdom and truth are not persuaded on the stage of debate, nor the force of the acclaim, power to control the evidence, or even the length of supporting details and long rhetorical explanation. It is manifest in the calm assurance of the conclusion. Of course, it has evidence, but it will be manifest in the beauty, the harmony, and the mark of the divine finger and purpose and pattern of the whole. If others see it differently, they're welcome to their mind on the matter. But in a calm confidence, I need not contend or convince the gainsayer. In fact, it is nearly impossible. Wisdom and truth will manifest itself in due course. In other words, the fruitage, the evidence will be manifest in time. And therefore, if our foundation is in the truth, we can have a calm confidence of its outcome, whether others believe it for now or not. Time will tell. If I must learn the wisdom of truth, it will also be with meekness and understanding of the Word and Spirit of God. Not with the force of rhetoric, argument, scholastic theses, or even appeal to consensus. truth is always and mostly hidden with the few and not the many. So coming now to verse 14. James says not to glory with envying and strife. Doing so is a lie against the truth. It may not be a lie against ourselves, for the fountain within may indeed be salted. But it is a lie, a misrepresentation of the truth. Misrepresentation of things as they really are, of the facts. These things need not shout down the opposition with a flaming tongue. Peter expresses the same thing in 1 Peter 3, verse 9. Not rendering evil for evil, or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that ye should inherit a blessing. Moving on to 15 through 16, which has had considerable consideration and lessons by the brethren over the years. It will be noticed that true wisdom descends, that is, comes down from above. It is the same thought that he shared in the first chapter that Brother West covered in verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variables, neither shadow of turning. That's the source. The source is not in ourselves. In 1920, Albert Einstein was asked how he researched and learned the unknown theory of light and relativity. You know, all of the professors that went before him used conventional theories that Einstein said just don't seem to work. He couldn't find it in textbooks. What was his answer? He said, I want to know how God created the world. I'm not interested in this or that phenomenon. I want to know his thoughts. The rest are details. Essentially, he was saying that he watched to see how God created light. In a sense, this was wisdom from above. Not from worldly knowledge or education or teachers or professors. In all lower wisdom, there is contention, strife, confusion. Such is manifest in a university, political science, physical science, the courtrooms, and also theological contention and debates. But this is wisdom is from above. And brethren, we have a special source that even Einstein had not, and that is careful attention to the words of the Almighty, the prophets, the teachers, the patriarchs, the apostles, messengers, and especially of his beloved son. So what is the wisdom from above? Verses 17 and 18 say this is the subject, and it is concludes the last two verses. So our treatment may be a little short. It is more than just defining wisdom. It regards the spirit and conduct which manifests wisdom. The conduct, the behavior. There have been more discourses on these two verses than the rest of the chapter, so we need not spend an hour on it. You already know that wisdom is the faculty of discerning or determining what is most true, just, and proper. Better yet, it is the way of manifesting and sharing that. It is something more than only stating what is believed to be true, but how to share its truthfulness. So purity is primary. It must be clean, uncontaminated, undiluted with human reasoning, philosophy, contention, and presumption. That is like pure grape juice, not a little juice and a lot of water and flavors and phosphates and color. Otherwise, we would say, be honest, innocent, clear, and transparent. Then, James says, it is peaceable. Here is being free from feuds and quarrels, a quiet disposition, undisturbed with passion and anxiety. Any other preoccupation is sure to harbor bias and retort. And I suppose every one of us are subject to this adrenaline factor. We become defensive. And soon the reasoning and example fly out the window. A peaceable heart and mind will calmly consider all aspects of matters for the blessing of the hearer. It does not necessarily need to agree with the opposer, but the peaceable mind and conduct will also be a hallmark that will support the truth of matters, or it will humbly be taught and enlightened by that source of light from above. And so he says it is gentle and easy to be entreated. It seems to connect in one attribute of wisdom received from on high. Gentle and easy to be entreated. Harshness always carries an edge of judgment or accusation against opposition. Gentleness says, here is how I see matters, and you can do with it what seems best for you. To be entreated means, in the gentle approach, we also need to equally receive sincere rationale and evidence that we had not considered before. This does not mean to embrace every differing view, but to consider whether it has validity. But it does mean to be disposed to weigh other views with the integrity with which they are offered. And I would say that sometimes the exchange is not always with integrity. We would like to enlist integrity from the hearer as well as in our own tongue. we might be persuaded when the harmony and beauty of the whole subject is more greatly revealed. And that is one of the keys to the whole process of interchange. We are looking for the harmony, the beauty, the simplicity, the verity of the whole subject. Oftentimes we get lost in the details and contending about some detail which only complicates and overshadows the beauty of the whole. Or we forget to go back and say, where did I first learn this beautiful parallelism, typical significance, character lesson, prophecy of Daniel, Jeremiah, of Ezekiel? Where was the beauty of their words? Or do we get tangled in the detail? But to weigh the harmony and the beauty is a way that we can learn as well as we can appeal to others. All this avoidance of contention and party spirit might seem to embrace the world of tolerance, diversity, liberty, and change as we see the world today. The world contends over homosexuality, gender change, pro-life and abortion, social and capital politics, conversation and conservation, rather, and global warming, human rights and human evils, medical and holistic health, contrived and actual history. You know, sometimes history is rewritten by those who never lived through it, rather than listening to those who did. Differences in biblical truth and understanding is even larger. It has become the norm to give every view its hearing. Expression is live and let live. All are okay with their views. But that is not the message of peace, and is not really the message of James either. We can affirm the light and truth without contending with darkness. And that's what Jesus did when he was tempted of Satan. Darkness must fade under the power of the sun. Jesus' answers were direct and explicit in what the Heavenly Father says. Wisdom is full of mercy and good fruits. It also connects, as mercy is certainly one fruit of character, this readiness to pass by weakness, inadvertent transgressions, or repeated of mistakes must be genuine and not feigned. But mercy is more than releasing our grievance of another situation. Mercy is something more. It extends to doing good, caring, and repairing their dilemma if it's possible. It was so with the Good Samaritan. It is true for spiritual Israel and for natural Israel. Romans 11:31. Even so have these also now not believed that through your mercy, they might also obtain mercy. That mercy also includes reform. Of course, this requires some discretion, as not to facilitate or perpetuate weakness. That's the balance. Sometimes excessive indulgence and another's weakness perpetuates the weakness. some measure of consequences can strengthen attention and resolve before relief is offered. Also, watching for progress is appropriate, yet without suspicion towards an offender. Wisdom will exercise these things without partiality or hypocrisy. Divine wisdom is consistent. Partiality springs from the will and affections rather than from a love of truth and justice. Luke 6:33. If ye do good to them which do good to you, what thank have you? For sinners also do the same. What is it to do good to opposers and the unthankful? Or if we offer alms to the wayward, is it for their good or for show and display to our peers? Verse 18 concludes this chapter. Those that sow in peace will reap a harvest of peace. Now, that may not be realized until the world recognizes the Emmanuel, the Prince of Peace. It may be noted that if this James was the same who presided at Jerusalem conference, there was enough sincere struggle with differences to frame this thesis. May the Lord add his blessing.